You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, as the Civil War sesquicentennial draws to a close, we remember one of the most controversial and divisive events in the war's history. Even today, the name Sherman draws a visceral reaction in certain parts of the South. General William Tecumseh Sherman's march from Atlanta to the sea and up through the Carolinas has been called variously one of the seminal events that hastened the end of the war to the first major war crime in our history. In fact, a whole mythology has surrounded this campaign. My guest today is a Civil War historian specializing in this particular event, and Sarah Rubin, who has extensively studied the reality of the march, as well as the myths and memories surrounding the event that still arouse deep passions 150 years later. She's the author of Through the Heart of Dixie, Sherman's March in American Memory. It's published by University of North Carolina Press. Rubin is a professor of history at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. She joins us today on Studio Tulsa. And Sarah Rubin, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Your most recent book is focused on one of the most mythologized, controversial, and divisive campaigns during the American Civil War. That was General William Tecumseh Sherman's march across Georgia to the sea and then up through the Carolinas towards the end of the war. As we approach that 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War, how important was this march in hastening its end?
That's a great question, and it's actually one that over the course of the book, my feelings about it really changed, so that when I started researching the book, I didn't think it was that crucial. And yet by the end of it, I thought it was incredibly important in bringing about the end of the war, because Sherman's men destroyed so much of the heartland of the Confederacy at that point, the places that still had food, the places that still had supplies. And in so doing that, they were able to deny those supplies to the Confederate armies in the field. They also, by the end, by April, they were pushing up towards, they were in North Carolina, pushing up towards Richmond. And so I think that pressure also accelerated the end of the war.
Now, why did you think it was not that important at first?
I started this project really, I think, under the spell of the mythologizing of Sherman's march, where I thought it was mostly in Georgia and the Carolinas part was more of an afterthought. In doing my research, I came to realize that strategically, I think the Carolinas section was more important. That's what Sherman always said himself. And I think some of it, too, was so much of what we think about the American Civil War, even today, is very, very Virginia-centric.
Right. And so, well, that's where most of the major battles were.
Right. There's so much fighting in Virginia, but there's so much fighting that's going on outside of Virginia. And I do think once you shift your perspective outside of Virginia, you start to see how important some of these other campaigns were.
This was the one place, after he took Atlanta across Georgia, this was a place that was literally untouched by war for the most part until that particular point.
That's exactly right. And that's one of the things I emphasize in the book and one of the things I emphasize when I give talks is Sherman's men are astounded by the incredible variety of food they have to eat. And it's that variety of food is why they're there, is that this is the place that hadn't seen fighting. And so they were still producing all kinds of foodstuffs. And Sherman's men take what they can eat, destroy everything that they leave behind so that the Confederacy literally starves to death.
And the plantation system, when they arrive there, is still, or at least prior to their arrival, is still operating.
Absolutely. It's weakening already just because of the ways that African Americans used the chaos of the war in general to take advantage and to often free themselves. But they certainly accelerate the end of the plantation system.
Now, let's take a step back for a moment for those who don't remember their Civil War history or never learned their Civil War history. This begins in 1864, first with Sherman pushing down to Atlanta. This, you know, the war had always been centered about taking Richmond. There was a Western theater, but that was really a sort of a sidelight to the whole idea of taking Richmond. Grant comes in. He says, I'm going to basically not have a battle, lose, and retreat.
Right.
I'm going to keep attacking. And Sherman, you go to Atlanta and just basically cut the Confederacy in two.
Right. And Atlanta's really important because it's a rail junction. In fact, the city's original name was Terminus. And so the point with taking Atlanta is by taking Atlanta, you're cutting off that rail link from the southern part of the Confederacy up towards Richmond. And so over the course of May and June into July, Sherman marches down from Chattanooga to Atlanta on the Atlanta campaign.
These were a series of bitter battles all the
way
down.
Very, very bitter battles, the kinds of battles that, frankly, Sherman didn't really like fighting. Then they lay siege to Atlanta, and then finally the Union Army breaks into Atlanta and takes Atlanta on September 2nd, 1864, which is really important because up until that point, Lincoln's reelection was very much in doubt because the war had been kind of stymied. So Sherman taking Atlanta really ensures Lincoln being reelected.
That's right. Farragut taking Mobile was probably the other bigger, the naval admiral who took Mobile Bay.
Right. So then what Sherman does in Atlanta is the first thing he does is he expels the civilians from Atlanta. He doesn't want to have to worry about feeding them. He doesn't want to have to worry about them spying on him. And he knows he's not going to stay in Atlanta, and he doesn't want to have to leave any soldiers behind to hold on to this city. And what's fascinating about that incident is there's an exchange of letters between him and Confederate General John Bell Hood, and also him, Sherman, and the mayor of Atlanta. And this is where Sherman, in a response to the mayor of Atlanta, famously writes, "War is cruelty, and you cannot refine it," which I think really defines how he sees war. So then, in the beginning of November, they get ready to march out of Atlanta towards the sea, towards Savannah. Right before they leave, they burn everything of military value in the city. That winds up burning about a third of the city of Atlanta, which is, frankly, the best thing that ever happened to Atlanta. Atlanta really seizes on that, on rebuilding itself after the war. In fact, they put the Phoenix on their city seal. So it's Atlantans sort of embraced this opportunity for rebirth in ways that other places maybe didn't.
Right.
And then on November 15th, they march out of Atlanta and start heading towards Savannah.
And when they head to Savannah, this is where the mythology really takes over.
Exactly.
Because there's probably more of annoyance of military forces arrayed against them rather than any sort of organized battles.
Right.
And basically, they're living off the land. And the mythology is there was a 50-mile swath of destruction across Georgia to Savannah, and then from Savannah up through the Carolinas.
Right. And what I also think about that mythology is that you think of that as a 50-mile-wide sort of lawnmower strip, right, that they're mowing everything down in their path. It's more complicated than that, which is that Sherman's army is divided into a left wing and a right wing, and then the left wing and right wing are further subdivided. So it's actually four columns marching. So when you say it's 50 miles across, it's 50 miles from the edge of one column to the furthest edge of the furthest column. So the metaphor I like to use is it's more like stitches so that they're there, but there's spaces in between. And a lot of what I do in my book is unpack some of the mythologizing that has grown up surrounding not just the places that Sherman's men destroyed, but often the more interesting stories are the places that are somehow spared by Sherman's men. And why are they spared? Are they spared because pretty girls lived there? Or, you know, there's a Masonic emblem that the family hangs up to protect themselves. Those are the stories I find really interesting.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the mythology surrounding this. And again, opinions still to this day are bitterly divided in the South, especially by race. African-Americans view Sherman, Grant, as heroes, family heroes for these families that, that escaped slavery. Sherman becomes a hero to them. For white Southerners, a very, very different image.
Yeah, I think white Southerners almost uniformly see Sherman as a villain. For African Americans, Sherman's more complicated. And that's another issue that I really unpack. Because for them, on the one hand, yes, Sherman and his army is an army of liberation. And you can make the argument that they're the largest army of liberation in the Civil War. There's no way you can know how many people Sherman's army freed. But what I did was I went back and using the census data for 1860, I figured out that the counties they passed through over the course of the march housed something like 400,000 enslaved people. So a lot of these people are being freed by Sherman's army. The problem, though, is that Sherman's army isn't always comfortable with being liberators, or they're not necessarily motivated by emancipation, so that they're not always kind to African Americans. The other issue is, of course, when Sherman's men destroy all of the food on a plantation, they're not just starving the whites, they're starving African Americans too. And so it's this more complex memory of Sherman's march and the ways that African Americans are both sort of grateful to Sherman and praise Sherman, but also recognize that they suffered too, along with whites, that I think makes the march more interesting.
Now, for white Southerners, though, Sherman is the ultimate villain, and there's a lot of mythologies that grow out of those memories that still persist today. One is of, you know, we think of Sherman's march as being one of the first instances of total war, and certainly it was, but with the images of total war, we also think of widespread rapes, and this is something that is sort of seared into a lot of psyches of white Southerners, that this was a mob. And was that the case?
It is and isn't the case. Which is to say that, yes, Sherman's march is brutal and violent and terrifying to white Southerners. And it certainly is total war in the sense of total war in the Civil War, right? The kind of fighting that you see, or not fighting really, but the kind of campaigns against civilians that you see in other places during the war as well, along the borders.
Yes. Missouri, Kansas.
Missouri and Kansas, yeah. And also along in the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia in the spring and summer of 1864.
And I would probably say the Missouri-Kansas is probably even rougher.
Kansas-Missouri is vicious, much more vicious.
I mean,
you're
talking
Sherman's
about
march.
Wholesale slaughtering of civilians. I don't think you find that, really.
Exactly. That's exactly the distinction that I try to make. And also, when Sherman becomes this symbol as the originator of total war, and that people will argue, you know, you can sort of trace this line from Sherman's march up through World War II and into Vietnam and the kinds of, you know, the My Lai massacre and things like that. I would argue that you can't actually do that, because the biggest difference, Sherman's march was a war against property, but they're not rounding up civilians and imprisoning them. They're not rounding up civilians and killing them. There certainly is rape and sexual assault on Sherman's march. It's very hard to find documented cases of it, but I think we can assume that it's happening, but it's not being used as a weapon, a sort of tactical weapon, the way that we see it done in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Now, again, perception versus reality. The perception is rape was widespread. What I've read is that most historians say it was rare.
I think it's happening somewhere in that middle ground, which is to say that I have not been able to find very many documented cases of rapes against white women. I found a few. I think there are probably sexual assault happening against African-American women that's not documented. But no, it's not the kind of widespread, organized.
Well, let me ask you this. Did the Army prosecute?
Very few prosecutions. Okay. I've spoken to somebody who's been doing research in this, and they found very few. I mean, there's very few prosecutions in general. I don't know that there's any along the line of Sherman's march, in part maybe because they're also moving so fast. You know, they don't stay places very long except for Savannah, really. The other piece of it, I think, is this notion that is Sherman a war criminal is a big question. In fact, you can, when you Google Sherman, that's one of the, you know, is Sherman a terrorist?
Well, you did a New York Times piece here recently, and there was one of the responses was, this guy is a war criminal. He should have been prosecuted into the law. And it was a really interesting debate in the comments.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he is a war criminal. I think Sherman is somebody who knew the laws of war as they stood in 1864. I think he skates right up to the edge of that line, and he doesn't step over it. You know, he gets in an argument. In fact, that argument I was referring to earlier about the expulsion of civilians from Atlanta. And he gets in this really testy exchange with John Bell Hood, and where John Bell Hood is basically saying, you're violating the laws of war. And Sherman writes back and says, I think I very well know the laws of war. So he knows what he's doing. I think the other piece that people forget about Sherman is that he loved white Southerners. He loved the South. He was not a supporter of emancipation. He was certainly not a supporter of black equality. He had lived in the South. He had lived, in fact, in South Carolina and in Georgia when he was a young officer. And so for Sherman, he's very clear-eyed about what he's doing. And he always felt that if white Southerners wanted him to stop, they could stop him. They just had to surrender. And the moment that they surrendered, he offered a very soft peace. He, over the years, in fact, in the years of Reconstruction and after, he's not, I wouldn't maybe say he was popular in the South, but he's not unpopular.
I think I read somewhere where he gave a speech in Atlanta in 1881, and he's cheered for saying.
He does.
And this is, I mean, so did all this antipathy to Sherman sort of increase over the years as people sort of actually forgot what actually happened?
I think that's exactly what happened. So he goes back to Atlanta twice. He goes in 1879 as part of his job as general in chief of the army. He's doing a tour of the South and he's welcomed with open arms. They have balls for him and his wife and daughters are there. And then he comes back again in 1881 for the Cotton States Exposition and he gives a speech, although it's interesting, he gives this speech on Mexican War Veterans Day. And where you start to see this shift is around 1881. And a lot of historians have dated that shift to Jefferson Davis's book, The Rise and Fall of the Confederate Government, where he really attacks Sherman. And it's somewhere in there, I think, that you start to see this shift away from Sherman or this intensification of Sherman as the villain. You also start to see it in popular culture more around the turn of the century. So, for example, in the film Birth of a Nation, which is 1915, there's a scene that is depicting people being terrorized on Sherman's march. And it really is kind of dropped in the film. It doesn't really fit with anything else. And then you can't, of course, overestimate the impact of Gone with the Wind.
Hmm. My guest today is Civil War historian Ann Sarah Rubin. She's an associate professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and the author of Through the Heart of Dixie, Sherman's March and American Memory. It's published by the University of North Carolina Press. She also has an incredible multimedia website called shermansmarch.org where you can sort of see stories and see firsthand accounts of the march from Atlanta to the sea and then up through the Carolinas. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, earlier you said one of the things you found interesting was, yes, there were these paths of destruction, and I think I've read from park rangers or something like that that there's plenty of antebellum homes along the route that survived Sherman. You said what was most interesting is what didn't get destroyed.
Exactly. And part of what doesn't get destroyed actually in Georgia is private homes in general, that Sherman's men in the Georgia portion destroy all kinds of outbuildings, barns, cotton gins, storehouses, but they don't destroy very many private homes. They do more of that kind of destruction in South Carolina because they are much angrier when they come into South Carolina. They think South Carolina was the cause of the war. And Sherman in his memoirs has this passage that is just so disingenuous where he writes, you know, somehow the men had gotten the idea that South Carolina was the cause of all of this. And then he writes, you know, they wanted to attack with more vengeance and I didn't want them to lose their vigor and their fighting spirit, so I didn't really restrain them. So they let them take the gloves off in South Carolina. It's much more vicious there. And then North Carolina, the men are supposed to kind of put the gloves back on again because North Carolina did have more of a unionist population. They do it for the most part. But I think that's, again, one of these great myths is that they just destroyed houses willy-nilly. So what I find interesting also is that, okay, your house is left standing. You need to explain why that happened. And the explanations are so revealing, which is, as I said earlier, often pretty girls, a pretty girl lived there now, a pretty girl used to live there that Sherman had known, or the power of the Masonic Brotherhood for saving these houses, or the cleverness of Southern women. A woman might run out the door yelling, smallpox, smallpox, and so the soldiers would stay away. Things like that, and also how people were able to hide their valuables from the soldiers, whether it was burying them or bricking things up in the stove. My favorite stories are women would take their jewelry and their wallets and shove them into their baby's diapers because they knew no man was going to go in there. Things like that, which become a way, I think, for white Southerners to take away this sense of victimization that came with Sherman's March and instead transform it into these stories of outsmarting the soldiers.
Now, one of the sources you use is a lot of the WPA African-American histories from the Depression where people are talking to former slaves and there are really interesting accounts there. It says, I remember one gentleman was saying, yeah, the soldiers came up, says, was our master good to us? And that sort of determined whether they burned the place or not.
Yeah, those WPA narratives are fascinating. And there are about 70 or 75 that I used that talked pretty directly about experiences with Sherman and Sherman's soldiers. And some of them, they do talk about how the soldiers come up and ask, was your master kind? Some of them in this same vein talk about Sherman himself coming on the plantation or freeing them. Some of them talk about Lincoln himself coming on their plantations and freeing them, which to me is so fascinating because it shows that people want to remember this great moment of their lives as this moment of incredible drama. with incredible power. So they're a really wonderful source to use.
Now, earlier we were talking about the march across Georgia. Once the Army does get to South Carolina, do you in fact think that war crimes occurred there? Because you're talking about wholesale burnings of towns. I think Columbia, it's still hotly debated whether it was retreating Confederates or the Union coming in that burned the whole capital down. What's your assessment?
I still don't think these fall to the level or rise to the level, I guess, of war crimes. The Columbia story is really interesting. I took part in a symposium in February commemorating the 150th anniversary of the burning of Columbia. It was open to the public. And I basically what I said was everybody burned Columbia, that it is retreating Confederates and it is Union soldiers. But Sherman himself very cannily and blames the Confederates. So I thought this is a nice tone to strike 150 years later, right? It's everybody's fault. It's the war's fault. Wow, that audience was not having any of it. I had people who had sheets of primary sources in their hands telling me how wrong I was, that it was all the Union soldiers. So it showed me how very much alive some of this still is.
Well, that was the next question I wanted to get into, is how does your book and your scholarship sort of affect this whole... You know, it's been amazing with the sesquicentennial that you've seen all of these opinions that says, you know, the accepted history is completely wrong. This is why the South was victimized. And there's still that body of a thought. How does your book and how does your scholarship go over in the South?
I think in general, it goes over really well. I was really surprised in Columbia that people were pushing back so hard, because I'd given a lot of talks. I actually gave talks in Augusta, Georgia, and in Atlanta, and in Milledgeville, Georgia, which was the antebellum capital, and people there received it really well. I mean, what I try to do in my book, what I didn't want to do was sort of create a value judgment or say, these are the stories people tell, and these stories are false, and here's the real story. I was much more interested and am much more interested in the way that the stories work together. Why do people tell stories? Why do people tell this particular story? And so I think because of that, because I give essentially equal weight to the narratives that white Southerners tell, because they were victimized, they did suffer, but also to the ways that Union soldiers, for example, remembered the march. They remembered the march pretty fondly. That because I think I'm pretty even-handed in my treatment, I think in general the book's been really well received, and people sense I try to be empathetic to all parties without saying you're wrong, you're right. I mean, certainly I think the way the war turned out is what should have happened, obviously.
Right, right. But you've mentioned the Union soldiers remember it quite fondly. Why in particular they remember it fondly? Obviously one reason was they were relatively safe on this during this whole campaign.
I think that's a huge piece of it. And they, one of my favorite sources to use are these recollections and reminiscences of Union veterans who would meet and they would have reunions and things like that. They often use the language, this was a picnic, this was a, you know, a walk in the park.
Involving going into somebody's house and taking all the food.
Right, exactly. But the other thing I try to point out to people is these are, frankly, most of these guys are in their late teens, early 20s. They're not marching very far. They're doing about 10 miles a day when normally they would do 20. They have so much to eat and drink. And frankly, there's a lot of alcohol. And there's something I think about men of that kind of college age that often finds a little destruction kind of appealing. You're laughing because you know I'm right.
Right.
And so I think there's an element of that too, that for them, and mostly they're not getting shot at, which when you're a soldier and these guys are veterans, a lot of them have been in the war for 3 years at this point, not getting shot at every day is a good day. So that for them, the other piece of it is that they really do believe that they won the war, that without the march, the war would have gone on. And so they feel they're not ashamed of it. They're not troubled by it in the way that, for example, many soldiers who make war on civilians in the 20th and 21st centuries are really troubled by it. And I found that an interesting difference.
Mm-hmm. And of course, civilian casualties were fairly light during this whole march.
Very light.
And so what did they do? Just push them off the land or burn the house or no, that didn't really happen in Georgia, but it certainly happened mm-hmm. a lot in South Carolina.
Yeah, they would burn the house. They would often burn the outbuildings. Sometimes they'd burn the cotton. They'd take the food. If they couldn't carry all the food, they might destroy the food, you know, pour out syrup or things like that, take the livestock. It's funny, I was talking earlier today with somebody about they would often, if they saw tracking dogs, the dogs that had been used to track runaway slaves, or what Sherman's men are really concerned about also is escaped Union prisoners, they would slaughter the dogs. Mm. They would trade out horses and mules and sometimes slaughter horses and mules. So they're not gentle. They're not kind, but they're sort of doing what they feel like they have to do.
They're destroying all sorts of rails along the way.
Right. You know, tearing down fences, ripping up the railroad lines. And then what they would do is they would take the metal rails, heat them in a big fire so they got soft, and then twist them and make what they called Sherman's neckties, these twisted rails, so that you couldn't easily rebuild the railroads. But they feel like, again, this is something Southerners brought upon themselves mm-hmm. by making war on the Union.
Have you been surprised by the diversity of opinion that still exists? I was talking about that New York Times article that you authored not too long ago. And really, there were a lot of people who felt like, hey, they got what they deserved. I mean, the reactions ran from this was a horrible war crime to they got what they deserved.
I was actually surprised in that the New York Times comments how many people said they got what they deserved. I expected a lot more of this was a horrible war crime and Sherman was a war criminal and how dare you. I was surprised by how many people felt they got what they deserved. But I think that's also perhaps a sample of the New York Times readership, which, I mean, is Northern
right.
based often and feels that way. I don't think I'm surprised by the diversity of opinion. What I'm delighted by is how many people still love the Civil War and want to read about the Civil War and want to talk about the Civil War. I think that's one thing the sesquicentennial has been wonderful for, is just rejuvenating public interests in this war. And what I think will be really interesting to see as the sesquicentennial of the war draws to a close is how do people talk about and reflect on and commemorate Reconstruction, which for the 100th anniversary, my impression is nobody talked about it.
Well,
it was
really
right during the Civil Rights Movement.
Really, nobody wanted to talk about the Civil War all that much as well during the centennial, because it's right in the middle of the Civil Rights Movement.
Right. And so I think what we have now before us is a tremendous opportunity to grapple with Reconstruction, which that's the legacy we're really living out even today.
Yeah. I remember at the 100th anniversary, all of a sudden there was this, you know, big movement to refer to it as the War Between the States. And I think that was all regional. If you were from the South,
yes.
It was War Between the States. There's sort of this revisionism going on. That has thankfully faded. And I think we have a pretty good view that the Civil War was fought over the preservation of slavery again. But still, these issues have not gone away.
No, they really haven't.
Wish you great success with
Thank
the book,
you.
Through the Heart of Dixie. Anne Sarah Rubin, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Civil War historian Anne Sarah Rubin speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She's an associate professor of history at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and the author of Through the Heart of Dixie, Sherman's March and American Memory. It's published by the University of North Carolina Press. By the way, she also has a great digital site, interactive digital site, titled shermansmarch.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.